arms wrap around the man's jacket collar, dragging him to the ground with me. We hit the ground hard, me on my back, him on my chest, both of us puffing out shocked breaths. When he goes for my hair again, I'm ready. I roll my head along the ground, evading his tug. Then I tilt forward, slamming my head against his own. My forehead connects with his nose, the cartilage bending. The man cries out and rolls off me, a hand to his blood-gushing nose. He rises to his knees. His fingers are stained red. Real pain and the memory pain spark through me like live wires on a car battery, jump-starting my muscles. It cracks the brittle shell around my memory. Tiny flecks of it fall away, beneath which are shimmering glimpses of the past. Him. In a similar crouch on the floor of Pine Cottage. A bloody knife within his grasp. Although I'm vaguely aware this is a different place in a different time, I see only him. So I dive on top of him, curled fists smashing against his face. I punch him a second time. A third. Rage takes over. Like a black ooze that's filling me up, spilling out of my pores, covering my eyes. I can no longer see, or hear, or smell. The only remaining sense is touch, and all I feel is pain in my fists as they smash into his face. When it becomes too much to bear, I rise to my feet, directing a kick at his skull. Then another, and another. Each blow comes with a name, bubbling forth against my will. I spit them out as if they're poison, spewing them onto him, covering him. Janelle, Craig, Amy, Rodney, that's... Quincy! That's not my voice. It's Sam's. Suddenly, she's right behind me, crushing me under her arms, dragging me away. Stop! She says, for God's sake, stop. I spend a few seconds fighting Sam's grip, thrashing and snarling. A feral dog trapped by a leash. I only ease up once I see the blood. It's a smear on Sam's hand, slick and dark. Seeing it makes me think I've hurt her. The very thought saps the rage out of me. Sam, I gasp, you're bleeding. I'm wrong. I realize that when I glimpse my own hands, seeing them soaked with blood. The same blood that got on Sam. The same blood that trickles down my arms, stains my clothes, splatters my face and neck in hot dollops. Some of it is mine. Most of it is not. Sam, what happened? Where were you? Instead of answering, she releases me, knowing I'm not going anywhere. In a flash, she's beside the man in the grass. He lies on his side, an arm flung out behind him and the other curled inward. I can't look at his face, but can't help but look at his face. What's left of it? His eyes are swollen shut. His broken nose seeps blood darker than the rest of his blood. He doesn't move. Sam pushes two fingers into the slick of blood at his neck, seeking a pulse. Worry creases her face. Sam, I say, as dizziness and fear and shock somersault through me. He's still alive, right? My vision blurs, Sam and the maybe-dead man veering in and out of focus. Right? Sam says nothing. Not when she runs her jacket sleeve across the spot she touched on the man's neck, erasing the indentation left by her fingers. Not when she snaps up the knife lying in the grass and drops it into her pocket. Not even when she drags me from the scene, unable to look at me as I wail. What did I do, Sam? What did I do? 19. We move quickly, a pair of fugitives hurtling through the darkness. Sam's thrown her jacket over my shoulders, her hand pressing the small of my back, pushing me forward. I keep going because I have to. Because Sam won't let me stop, even though all I want to do is collapse onto the ground and stay there. Breathing has become a chore. Each inhalation is hampered by an anxious shudder. Each exhalation is accompanied by a sob. My chest expands from the lack of oxygen, my desperate lungs pushing themselves against my ribs. "Stop," I gasp. "Please, let me stop." Sam increases the pressure at my back, forcing me onward. Past trees, past statues, past bums stretched across benches. When we come upon others, a man on a bike, three friends drunkenly walking arm in arm, she turns inward, shielding my blood-soaked body from view. We stop only when we reach the conservatory water, that elaborate pool where in the daytime kids watch their toy sailboats traverse the shallow water. I'm guided to the pool's edge, lowered to my knees, hands plunged into the water. Sam cleans me off as much as possible, splashing water onto my arms, my neck, my face. On the other side of the pool, a homeless man is doing the same thing to himself. When he stares at us, Sam yells, her voice skipping over the water. "What the fuck are you looking at?" The man backs away, grabbing his fistfuls of trash bags and disappearing in the darkness. Sam dips a hand in the water, scooping liquid onto my forehead. "Listen," she says, "I think he's still alive." I want to believe her, but I can't let myself. "No," I murmur. "I killed him." I felt a pulse. "Are you sure?" "Yeah," Sam says. "I'm sure." Relief pours over me, more cleansing than the water she continues to splash onto my blood-stained skin. I can breathe easier. My throat opens up, releasing another sob, this one grateful. "We need to call for help," I say. Sam lowers my hands into the water again, rubbing them beneath her own, erasing the evidence of my sin. "We can't do that, Quinn." "But he needs to get to a hospital." I try to pull my hands from the water, but Sam holds them under. "Calling 911 will get the police involved." "So?" I say. "I'll tell them I was acting in self-defense."
"And were you?"
"He had a knife."
"Was he going to use it?"
I can't answer that. Maybe he would have eventually. Or maybe he would have walked away. I'll never know. "He still had it," I say, unsure of who I'm trying to convince, Sam or myself. "The police wouldn't charge me if they knew that." Sam finally lifts my hands from the water, turning them over to see if any blood remains. It's all gone. My palms are pale and glistening.
"They would if they knew our reason for being out here," she says. "If they knew we were trying to lure someone. Especially if they found out you could have gotten away."
The only way she could know this is if she had been there. Hiding. Watching me the whole time. Watching even as the man's knife dropped from his pocket. For a moment, that particular truth eclipses everything else.
"You saw me?"
"Yeah."
"You were there?"
I start to hyperventilate again, my body racked by a series of lung-scraping gasps. The sudden lack of air makes me woozy. Or maybe that's just from shock. Either way, I have to steady myself against the pool's edge to keep from tilting over. When I speak, it's in sharp, ragged bursts.
"Why didn't you help?"
"You didn't need help."
"He had a knife," I say,
a warm slick of anger rising in my throat. It feels like a swallow of wild turkey moving in reverse, inching its way higher.
"You just sat back and fucking watched?"
"I wanted to see what you would do."
"And I almost killed a man. Happy? Was that the reaction you were looking for? Why didn't you try to stop me?"
"The question you should be asking is why you didn't try to stop yourself."
I manage to stand, shaking water from my hands before striding off, away from the pool, away from Sam.
Quinn, she yells to my back, don't go.
I'm going.
Where?
To the police.
They're going to arrest you.
It's the way she says it that stops me. Her voice is flat, the words alarmingly matter-of-fact. She's right, and I know it. Panic boils in the depths of my stomach. I'm the moth that got careless with the flame. Now I'm engulfed.
Knife or not?
The cops aren't going to understand, Sam says.
They'll only see you as a vindictive bitch who came here looking for trouble. You'll be arrested for aggravated assault. Maybe worse. The kind of charges your boy, Jeff, won't be able to talk the cops into dropping.
I think of Jeff, mere blocks away, oblivious in his slumber. This could ruin him. He has nothing to do with it, but no one would care. My guilt is enough to destroy us both. The dizziness returns, bringing with it a harsh tremble that paralyzes my legs. I sway, unsure how much longer I can remain upright. Sam keeps talking, only making it worse.
You'll be in the papers again, Quinn. Not just one, but all of them.
Oh, I'm sure of that. I picture the headlines. Final girl snaps, goes into violent rage. Jonah Thompson will have an orgasm over it.
There's no recovering from that, Sam says. If you go to the cops, life as you know it will be over.
The words are ugly in her mouth, even though she's only telling the truth. Yet I hate her all the same. Hate her for showing up, barging into my life, bringing me into this park. Mixed with that hate is another, more unwieldy emotion. Despair. It bubbles inside me, making me sweat and cry and feel so helpless that I long to plunge into the pool's water and never resurface.
What are we going to do?
I say, hopelessness splitting my voice.
Nothing, Sam says.
So we just leave the park and pretend it never happened?
Pretty much.
She picks up her jacket, which I had shrugged off at the water's edge. She puts it around my shoulders again, nudging me forward. Our pace is slower this time, both of us keeping watch for signs of police. We take a different route out of the park. Few people see us on our way from Central Park West to my building. Those who do probably write us off as two drunk girls stumbling home. My dizzy swaying helps sell the charade. Once home, I fill the tub in the guest bathroom and peel off my clothes. The amount of blood on them is gut-churning. It's not as bad as the white dress turned red at Pine Cottage, but close. Bad enough that I start sobbing again as I lower myself into the tub. Tendrils of pink form in the water, swirling slightly before vanishing into nothingness. I close my eyes and tell myself everything about tonight will disappear in the same manner. A flash of color quickly gone. The man in the park will live. Because he was carrying a knife, he won't mention what I did to him. Everything will be forgotten in a few days, weeks, months. I examine my knuckles and see that they've turned a ghastly bright pink. Pain pulses through them. A similar ache throbs in the foot I had used to kick the man into unconsciousness. More sensations from earlier in the night come back to me. The pulling of my hair. Seeing him crouched on the floor, bloody knife within his grasp. Memories.
Not of tonight, but of 10 years ago. Of Pine Cottage. Of things I thought I had forgotten.
I tell myself that they can't be. That almost everything bad about that night has been sliced from my mind. But I know I'm wrong. I had remembered something. Rather than sit up, I hunch down farther in the tub, hoping the hot water will wash it all away. I don't want to remember what happened at Pine Cottage. That's the reason I've mentally cut it out of my brain, right? Because it was all too horrible to keep in my head. Yet, like it or not, there's no denying something has come back to me tonight. Nothing major, just a brief flash of memory. Like a faded photograph. But it's enough to make me shiver even while neck deep in the steaming tub. There's a quick knock at the door. A warning from Sam that she's about to enter. She manages one step before being stopped cold by my bloody clothes on the tiled floor. Wordlessly, she scoops them up.
What are you going to do with them? I ask.
Don't worry about it. I know what to do, she says before carrying them out of the bathroom. Yet I am worried about the memories that have suddenly scurried back into my consciousness. About the man in the park. About why Sam stayed back and watched as I beat him senseless, as if it were simply another one of her unspoken tests. Suddenly, I'm struck with a thought. A question, really, made hazy and distant by the steam rising off the water and my own exhaustion. How does Sam know what to do with my bloody clothes? And another, why was she so calm as we fled the scene of my crime? Now that I think about it, she was more than calm. She was utterly thorough in the way she whisked me from the scene, making sure to shield me and the blood from onlookers, finding a water source in which I could be cleansed. No one could be that efficient in such a situation. Not unless they had done it before. Those thoughts are quickly followed by another one. Not a question this time. A certainty, screaming into my brain so fast and loud that I bolt upright in the tub, water sloshing over the sides. The purse. We left it behind in the park. 20. Don't worry about it, babe. That's what Sam tells me after I inform her about the missing purse. I already know that. If it was important, I would have taken it with us. We're in her room, she smoking by the window, me nervously perched on the edge of the bed. And you're positive there's nothing incriminating in it? I ask. Positive, Sam says. Now, get some sleep. There's so much more I should be asking. What did she do with my bloody clothes? Why did she let me snap like that in the park? Was I so violent and unhinged that it summoned that brief glimpse of him at Pine Cottage? All remains unsaid. Even if I asked, I know Sam wouldn't answer me. So I leave, heading to the kitchen for a Xanax and grape soda chaser before lying down on the sofa, ready for another sleepless night. To my surprise, I do manage to drift off. I'm too exhausted to fight it. Yet my slumber is brief, interrupted by a nightmare of Lisa, of all people. She's standing in the middle of Pine Cottage, blood gushing from her slit wrists. In her hands is Sam's purse, getting splashed with gore. She holds it out to me, smiling, saying, "You forgot this, Quincy." I awake with a start, sitting up on the sofa, limbs flailing. Although the entire apartment is silent, I sense the reverberations of an echo in the living room. A scream, probably, bursting from my mouth. A minute passes in which I wait for someone to inevitably wake up. Surely Jeff and Sam heard it. Or maybe I didn't scream after all. Maybe it was just in the dream. Outside the window, the night sky is quickly thinning. Dawn's on its way. I know I should try to get more sleep, that I'll collapse soon without it. But my nerves are a sparking jumble. The only way to calm them is to go back to the park and see if the purse is still there. So I tiptoe into the bedroom, relieved to find Jeff fully asleep, snoring lightly. Quickly, I wrap myself in running clothes. I then slip fingerless gloves onto my hands to hide the abrasions that roll over my knuckles, already beginning to scab. Once outside, I cross the blocks to the park at a dead sprint. I blast over Central Park West, crossing against the light, making an approaching cab slam on its brakes to avoid hitting me. The driver honks. I ignore him. In fact, I ignore everything as I fly to the spot where the purse had been knocked from my hands. The same spot where I had beaten a man so much his face resembled a rotting apple. But now that man is gone. So is the purse. They've been replaced by police. A dozen officers milling around a wide square of yellow police tape. It looks like a murder scene. The kind you see on cop shows. Officers search the taped-off area, conferring with one another, sipping coffee from steaming paper cups. I hang back, jogging in place. Despite the hour, several other onlookers are also there, standing in the blue-gray dawn. "What happened?" I ask one of them, an older woman with an equally geriatric-looking dog. "Guy got attacked. Beat real bad." "That's awful," I say, hoping I sound appropriately sincere. "Will he be okay?" "One of those cops says he's in a coma." She practically whispers the word, putting a scandalous spin on it. "City's full of sickos." Inside, I feel a thorn bush of emotions, tangled and jagged. There's joy that the man is still alive, that I haven't killed him after all. Relief that his coma means he can't talk to the police just yet. Guilt for being so relieved. And worry. That, above all else. Worry about the purse, which could have been found by the police, or stolen, or dragged into the thicket by the coyotes that sometimes, inexplicably, find their way to the park. It doesn't matter what happened to it. As long as it remains out of our possession, that purse has the potential to tie me to the beating. My fingerprints are all over it. Which is why I come home with my mouth set in a grim scowl. Jeff is awake when I slip through the front door, standing in the kitchen in a t-shirt and boxers. "Quincy, where have you been?" "I went for a jog," I say. "At this hour? The sun's not even up." "I couldn't sleep." Jeff peers at me through puffy eyes, the lingering fog of sleep hovering around him. He scratches his head. He scratches his crotch. He says, "Is everything okay? This isn't like you, Quinn." "I'm fine," I say, clearly not. My body feels hollow, as if my insides have been scraped out by the ice cream scoop I use to drop batter into muffin tins. "Just fine." "Is this about last night?" I freeze in front of him, wondering what, if anything, he heard last night. That I'm keeping a secret from him at all makes me quiver with guilt. That he could possibly know about it only makes it worse. "Me having to go to Chicago?" he says. I exhale, slowly, so as not to arouse suspicion. "Of course not." "You seemed pretty annoyed about it." "Believe me, I am. I don't love the idea of leaving you alone with Sam." "We'll be fine," I say. Jeff squints slightly, frowning just so. The perfect picture of concern. "Are you sure everything is okay?" "Yes," I say. "Why do you keep asking me that?" "Because you were out jogging before 6, Jeff says. "And because you just found out that Lisa Milner was murdered, and that there are no suspects." "Which is why I couldn't sleep. Which led to the jogging." "But you'd tell me if something was wrong, right?" I force a smile, trembling from the effort.
"Of course."
Jeff pulls me into a hug. He's warm and soft and smells faintly of sweat and fabric softener from the sheets. I try to hug him back, but can't. I'm undeserving of such affection. Later, I make him breakfast while he gets ready for work. We eat in silence, me hiding my injured hand under a dish towel or on my lap, while Jeff leafs through the New York Times. I take furtive peeks at each turning page, positive I'll see an article about the man in the park, even though I know it's too early. My crime was past their deadline. That particular hell will have to wait until tomorrow's edition. As soon as Jeff leaves, I pull the key from around my neck and open my secret kitchen drawer. The pen Sam stole in the cafe is there. I pick it up and scrawl a single word across my wrist. Survivor. Then I hop into the shower, forcing myself not to blink as I watch the water smear the ink away. Sam and I don't talk. We bake. Our tasks are well defined. Apple tart tatin with caramel sauce for me. Sugar cookies for Sam. Our workstations are laid out on separate ends of the kitchen, like opposing sides in a war sharing a common front. While I make the dough for the tart, I keep checking my hands for signs of blood, certain I'll find lingering crimson stains across my palms. All I see is flesh turned puffy and pink from being washed too many times. "I know you're having second thoughts," Sam says. "I'm fine," I say. "We did the right thing."
"Did we?"
"Yes." I've started on the Honeycrisp apples, my hands trembling slightly. I stare at the red-yellow apple skins, which fall in long, drooping spirals. My hope is that if I concentrate on them hard enough, Sam will stop talking. It doesn't work. "Going to the police now won't make things right again," she says, "no matter how much you want it to." It's not that I want to go to the police. I think I have to. I know from Jeff's work that it's always better for a criminal to come forward rather than get caught. Cops have at least a grudging respect for those who confess. So do judges. "We should tell Coop," I say. "Are you out of your goddamn mind? He might be able to help us." "He's still a cop," Sam says. "He's my friend. He would understand." At least, I hope he would. He said many times that he'd do anything to protect me. Is that the truth? Or is there a limit to Coop's loyalty? After all, he made that promise to the Quincy he thinks he knows, not the one who actually exists. I'm not sure it would still apply to the Quincy who's already taken 2 Xanax since returning from the park this morning. Or the Quincy who steals shiny objects just so she can see her reflection in them. Or the Quincy who pummels a man until he's comatose. "Let it drop, babe," Sam says. "We're good. We got away. It's over." "And you're absolutely certain there was nothing in that purse that could lead to us?" I ask for what's probably the 50th time. "I'm positive," Sam says. "Chill out." Yet an hour later, my phone rings as I'm pulling the tart tatin from the oven. I place the tart on the counter, tear off an oven mitt, and grab the phone. Answering it brings a woman's voice to my ear.
"May I speak to Miss Quincy Carpenter?"
"This is Quincy."
"Miss Carpenter, I'm Detective Carmen Hernandez with the NYPD.
Fear freezes me. A sudden, numbing chill. How I manage to keep hold of the phone is a mystery. The fact I can still speak is a minor miracle.
"How can I help you, Detective?"
Hearing this, Sam whirls away from the counter, a large mixing bowl hugged to her stomach.
"I was wondering if you had time to come to the station today,"
Detective Hernandez says. I only half listen to the rest of what she has to say. The deep freeze of fear has made its way to my ears, blocking out a good deal of it. Yet the key words are clear, like blows of a pickaxe against the ice. "Central Park. Purse. Questions. Lots of questions.
Of course, I say. I'll be there as soon as I can.
Once I end the call, the frigid grip of fear subsides. Taking its place is the hot burn of despair. Trapped between cold and heat, I act accordingly, melting into a puddle on the kitchen floor.
2 days after Pine Cottage. Their names are Detective Cole and Detective Fremont, although they might as well have been called Good Cop and Bad Cop. Each had a role to play, and they performed them well. Cole was the nice one. He was young, probably not yet 30. Quincy liked his friendly eyes and the warm smile that sat beneath a wispy mustache grown in an attempt to make him look older. When he crossed his legs, Quincy saw that his socks matched the green of his tie. A nice touch. Fremont was the gruff one. Short, stout, and balding, he had the jowls of a bulldog. They flopped slightly when he said, "We're confused by something." "More curious than confused," Cole added. Fremont shot him an annoyed look. "Things just don't add up, Miss Carpenter." They were in Quincy's hospital room, she too sore to leave the bed. Instead, she was propped into a sitting position by several pillows. There was an IV needle in her arm, its low, perpetual sting distracting her from the detective's words. "Things?" she said. "We have questions," Cole said.
"A bunch of them," Fremont said.
"I've already told you everything I know." That was the previous day, when Quincy had been so groggy with painkillers and grief that she wasn't sure what she had said. But she covered the basics. She was certain of that. Yet Fremont glared at her, his eyes bloodshot and weary. His suit had seen better days, the cuffs frayed. A yellow splotch of dried mustard marred one of the lapels, a ghost of lunches past.
"That wasn't a whole lot," he said.
"I don't remember a lot."
"We're hoping that you might be able to remember more," Cole said. "Could you try? Just for me? I'd really appreciate it."
Leaning back into the pillows, Quincy closed her eyes, searching for something else she could remember from that night. But it was all a black stew, turbulent and dark. She saw before Janelle emerging from the woods, the flash of blade. She saw after, running through the forest, the branch whacking her face as rescue appeared on the horizon. The in-between, however, was gone. Still, she tried. Eyes and fists clenched, she swam through that mental stew, diving under, searching for the tiniest memory. She came up with only fragments, glimpses of blood, of the knife, of his face. They didn't add up to anything substantial. They were lost puzzle pieces, giving no hint of the complete picture. "I can't," Quincy finally said as she opened her eyes, shamed by the tears threatening to slide from them. "I'm sorry, but I really can't." Detective Cole patted her arm, his palm surprisingly smooth. He was even more handsome than the cop who had saved her. The one with the blue eyes, who immediately rushed to her side yesterday after she cried out that she wanted to see him.
"I understand,"
Cole said.
"I don't,"
said Fremont, the folding chair beneath him creaking as he shifted his weight.
"Did you really forget everything that happened the other night? Or do you just want to forget it?"
"It's completely understandable that you do," Cole quickly added. "You suffered a great deal."
"But we need to know what happened," Fremont continued. "It doesn't make sense."
Confusion clouded Quincy's thoughts. A headache was coming on, a light, pulsing pain that exceeded the angry pinch of the IV needle in her arm.
"It doesn't," she said.
"So many people died," Fremont said. "Everyone but you."
"B-
Because that cop shot him. Already she had decided to never speak his name. I'm sure he would have killed me, too, if that cop...
Officer Cooper, Cole said.
Yes.
Quincy wasn't sure if she already knew that. Nothing about the name was familiar.
Officer Cooper, did you ask him about what happened?
We did,
Fremont said. And what did he say?
That he was instructed to search the woods for a patient reported missing from Blackthorn Psychiatric Hospital.
Quincy held her breath, waiting for him to speak that patient's name, dreading it. When he didn't, a warm rush of relief coursed through her.
During the search, Officer Cooper heard a scream coming from the direction of the cabin. On his way to investigate, he spotted you in the woods.
Quincy pictured it, the moment superimposed over the image of the two detectives beside her bed. Officer Cooper's surprise when he noticed a flash of white fabric at her knees, realizing how her dress had been dyed red with blood. Her stumbling toward him, gurgling those words that continually echoed through her pill-stuffed brain.
They're dead. They're all dead. And he's still out here.
Then, her latching onto him, pressing herself hard against him, smearing the blood, her blood, Janelle's blood, everyone's blood, all over the front of his uniform. They both heard a noise, a rustling in the brush several yards to their left. Him. Breaking through the branches, arms flapping, skinny legs churning, Coop drew his Glock, aimed, fired. It took three shots to take him down, two in the chest, their impact making his arms flail even more, like a marionette in the act of being abandoned by his puppeteer. Yet he kept coming. His glasses had slipped off one ear, the frames slanted across his face, magnifying only one surprised eye as Coop fired the third shot into his forehead.
And before that?
Fremont said.
What happened then?
Quincy's headache expanded, filling her skull like a balloon about to pop.
I truly, honestly, can't remember.
But you have to,
Fremont said, pissed off at her for something she had no control over.
Why?
Because certain things about that night don't add up.
The headache kept growing. Quincy shut her eyes and winced.
What things?
To be blunt,
Fremont said.
We can't understand why you lived when all the others died.
That's when Quincy finally heard it, the accusation hiding in his voice, peeking out suspiciously between his words.
Can you tell us why?
He asked. Just then, something inside of Quincy snapped. An angry shudder vibrated in her chest, followed by a surge of agitation. The balloon in her skull burst, tossing out words she never intended to say. Once she regretted as soon as they took flight off her tongue.
Maybe, she said, her voice like steel. I'm just tougher than they were.
21. Detective Hernandez is one of those women you can't help but admire even as you envy them. Everything about her is precisely put together, from the maroon blouse beneath a black blazer to the impeccably tailored slacks and boots with just a hint of a heel. Her hair is the color of dark chocolate, pulled back to display the perfect bone structure of her face. When she shakes my hand, it's both firm and friendly. She makes a point of pretending not to notice my battered knuckles. "Thank you for coming on such short notice," she says. "I promise this will only take a few minutes." I breathe. I try to keep calm, just the way Sam instructed after she picked me up off the kitchen floor. "I'm happy to help," I say. Hernandez smiles. It doesn't appear strained. "Fantastic!" We're in the Central Park precinct. the same place from which Jeff and I fetched Sam days earlier, although now it feels like years. The detective leads me up the same set of steps I climbed that long ago, not long ago at all, night. I'm then guided to her desk, which is free of clutter, save for a framed photograph of her, two kids, and a barrel-chested man I can only assume is her husband. There's also a purse. Placed on the center of the desk, it's the same purse Sam and I left in the park. Its presence isn't a surprise. We suspected it was the reason for the call and spent the walk to the precinct constructing an excuse as to why it and we were in the park last night. Yet my body freezes at the sight of it. Hernandez notices. "Do you recognize it?" she asks. I have to clear my throat before answering, dislodging the words stuck there like an accidentally swallowed chicken bone. "Yes, we lost it in the park last night." I want to retract the words as soon as I say them, pulling them back into my mouth like a serpent's tongue. "We?" Hernandez says. "You and Tina Stone?" I take a deep breath. Of course she knows about Sam and her new name. The detective is as smart as she looks. That realization makes me feel weak. Exhausted, really. When she sits behind her desk, I drop into a chair next to it. "Her real name is Samantha Boyd," I say meekly, nervous about correcting the detective. "She changed it to Tina Stone." "After what happened to her at the Nightlight Inn?" I take another deep breath. Detective Hernandez has certainly done her homework. "Yes," I reply. "She went through a lot. We both have, but I'm sure you know all about that. It's a terrible thing that happened. To both of you. Crazy world, right?" "It is." Hernandez smiles again, this time in sympathy, before opening the purse and pulling out several battered paperbacks. "We found the purse early this morning," she says, stacking books on the desk between us. "We traced it to Miss Stone after finding her name in one of these books. It came up in a quick scan of our records. Seems she was taken into custody a few nights ago. Assault on an officer and resisting arrest, I think it was." "That was a misunderstanding." I clear my throat again. "I believe the charges were dropped." "And so they were," Hernandez says as she inspects one of the books. Its cover bears a robot in the shape of a woman roaming a purple starscape. "You picked her up that night, correct?"
"I did. Me and my boyfriend, Jefferson Richards. He's with the public defender's office."
His name clangs a bell in the detective's memory. She gives me another smile, this one painfully strained.
"He's got quite a case on his hands, doesn't he?"
I swallow, relieved I didn't call Jeff and ask him to come to the station with me. I wanted to, of course, but Sam talked me out of it. She said bringing a lawyer, even one who was my boyfriend, would instantly arouse suspicion. Turns out it also would have brought him into contact with a detective none too pleased about him defending a man accused of killing a fellow cop.
"I don't know much about it," I say.
Hernandez nods before skipping back to the original subject. "Since we don't have a contact number from Miss Stone, I thought it wise to have a chat with you and see if you know of her whereabouts. Is she staying with you, perhaps?" I could lie, but there'd be no point to it. I get the sense the detective already knows the answer.
"She is," I say.
"And where is she now?"
"Waiting outside, actually."
At least, I hope she is. Although Sam was calm when we left the apartment, I suspect it was purely for my sake. Now that she's alone, I picture her pacing outside, finishing up her third cigarette in a row while sneaking glances through the precinct's glass-walled entrance. It occurs to me that while I'm in here, Sam could easily just leave town, again leaping off the grid. Honestly, I'm not sure that would be a bad thing.
"I guess it's my lucky day," Detective Hernandez says. "Do you think she'd want to come in and answer some questions?"
Sure. The word is high-pitched, akin to a squeak. I suppose so.
The detective reaches for the phone, taps a few numbers, and informs the desk sergeant on duty that Sam can be found outside.
Bring her in and have her wait outside my office, she says.
Is Sam in some kind of trouble? I ask.
Not at all. An incident occurred in the park overnight. A man was severely beaten.
I keep my hands on my lap, the ugly, scabby right one covered by the less ugly left.
That's terrible.
A jogger found him this morning, Hernandez continues. He was unconscious. A complete bloody mess. God knows what would have happened if he hadn't been discovered in time.
That's terrible, I say again.
Since Miss Stone's purse was found near the scene, I was wondering if she saw anything last night. Or you, for that matter, since you were apparently with her.
I was, I say.
And what time was this?
About one. Maybe a little after.
Hernandez leans back in her chair, steepling her well-manicured fingers.
A bit late to be roaming the park, no?
It was, I say. But we had been drinking. You know, girls' night out. And since I live near the park, we thought it would be quicker to cross it on foot instead of taking a cab. It's the alibi Sam and I had concocted on the way here. I worried that I might not be able to tell it, yet the lie comes without hesitation, slipping from my mouth with such ease it surprises even me. And that's when Miss Stone... Boyd, I say. Her real name is Samantha Boyd.
That's when Miss Boyd lost the purse?
It was taken, actually. Hernandez arches a perfectly sculpted brow.
Taken?
We stopped at a park bench so Sam could have a smoke. A pebble of truth tossed into the churning river of falsehood. While we were there, a guy ran by, grabbed the purse, and took off. We didn't report it stolen because, as you can see, there's nothing valuable in it.
Why was she carrying it in the first place?
Sam's a little paranoid about things, I say, furthering the lie. I can't blame her, considering what happened to her. To us, really. She told me she carries the purse for protection.
A nod from Detective Hernandez. Like a decoy?
A nod from me. Exactly. A mugger aims for the big stuff, like that purse, while neglecting the items of true value, such as her wallet. Hernandez studies me from across the desk, parsing the information, taking time to respond. It looks as if she's counting the seconds, waiting until a suitably intimidating length of time has passed. Finally, she says,
"Did you get a good look at the man who stole the purse?"
"Not really."
"Nothing at all?"
"It was dark," I say. "And he was wearing dark clothes. A puffy jacket, I think. I don't really know. It all happened so fast." I lean back in my chair, relieved and, I'll admit, exceedingly proud of myself. I had given our false alibi without a hitch. It was so convincing that even I almost believe it. But then Hernandez reaches into a drawer, removes a photograph, slides it across the desk.
"Could this be the man you saw?"
It's a mugshot of a young punk of a man. Wild eyes, neck tattoo, the papery skin of a junkie. The very same junkie whose nose collapsed beneath my forehead. Seeing his face makes my heart momentarily stop.
"Yes,"
I say with a gulp.
"That's him."
"This is the same guy who was found almost beaten to death this morning," Hernandez says, although I already know this. "His name is Ricardo Ruiz. Rocky, for short. He's homeless, an addict. The usual sad story. Cops patrolling the park know him pretty well. They say he didn't seem like the type of guy to get into much trouble. Only wanted a place to sleep and his next fix." I continue to stare at the photo. Knowing the man's name and what he's like makes my heart crack with guilt and remorse. I don't think about the fear I felt in the park.
I don't think about the knife he carried and that Sam scooped up. All I can focus on is the fact that I hurt him. Badly. So bad that he might never recover. That's awful, I manage to mutter. Will he be okay? Doctors say it's too soon to tell. But someone sure did a number on him. You two didn't happen to see anything suspicious last night? Someone running away from something, maybe? Or anyone acting shady? After the purse was taken, Sam and I left the park as fast as we could. We didn't see anything like that. I shrug, frowning for emphasis, showing her how much I long to help. I'm sorry I can't tell you anything else. When I talk to Miss Stone, I mean, Miss Boyd, she'll tell me the same thing? Of course, I say. At least, I hope she will. After last night, I'm not sure Sam and I are on the same side. You two are close, I imagine, Hernandez says. Going through similar ordeals. What's that name the papers call you? Final Girls. I say it angrily, with all the scorn I can muster. I want Detective Hernandez to know that I don't consider myself one of them. That I'm beyond that now, even if I no longer quite believe it myself. That's it. The detective senses my tone and wrinkles her nose in distaste. I guess you don't like that label. Not at all, I say. But I suppose it's better than being referred to as victims. What would you like to be called? Survivors? Hernandez leans back in her chair again, impressed. And are you and Miss Boyd close? We are, I say. It's nice to be around someone who understands me. Of course it is. She sounds like she means it. There's sincerity there, I think. Yet her face is pinched just a fraction. And you said she's staying with you? For a few days, yes. So the fact that she's had prior brushes with the law doesn't bother you? I swallow. Prior? As in, more than what happened the other night? I guess Miss Boyd neglected to tell you about those, Hernandez says, consulting her notes. I did a little digging into her recent history. Nothing big, just the past 5 years or so. In addition to being picked up for assault 2 nights before Rocky's unfortunate accident, she had a drunken disorderly arrest in New Hampshire 4 years ago, another one in Maine 2 years after that, and an unpaid speeding ticket following a traffic stop just last month in Indiana. The world stops just then. A sudden screeching halt that sends everything tilting. My hands slide off my lap and grip the underside of my chair, as if I might fall right out of it. Sam was in Indiana just last month. I try to smile at Detective Hernandez, to show her I'm unflappable, that I know everything there is to know about Sam. In reality, my mind fills with memories, flipping like pages of a photo album. Each memory is a snapshot. Bright, vivid, full of detail. I see Lisa's email on my phone, glowing ice blue in the darkness. Quincy, I need to talk to you. It's extremely important. Please, please don't ignore this. I see Jonah Thompson gripping my arm, his features tight. It's about Samantha Boyd. She's lying to you. I hear Coop's low, concerned voice. We don't know what she's capable of. I see Sam in the park, covering my stained clothes with her jacket, steering me toward water, washing the blood from my hands. So swift and decisive. I see those same clothes being scooped into her arms, as if it were a normal occurrence. Don't worry about it. I know what to do. I see her swearing a path through the crush of reporters outside, unafraid of the cameras, completely unfazed when Jonah tells us that Lisa's been murdered. Her face is painted white by the flashbulbs, turned the same shade as a corpse on the slab. There's no expression there. No sadness or surprise. Nothing.
Miss Carpenter?
The detective's voice sounds faint among the shuffling memories.
You okay?
I'm fine, I say. I know all about those. Sam has never lied to me. She hasn't. At least there's nothing I can definitively pinpoint as a lie. But she hasn't exactly told me the truth, either. Since her arrival, Sam hasn't told me much of anything. I don't know where she's been. I don't know who she was with. Most of all, I have no idea what horrible things she might have done. 22. The chill has returned to the park in full force, shocking in the same way water feels when you take that first plunge into a swimming pool. Change hangs in the air, a sense of time running out. Fall has officially arrived. Because of the weather, everyone moves with manic energy. Joggers and cyclists and nannies pushing ridiculous double-wide strollers. It makes them look like they're fleeing something, even though they travel in all directions. Willy-nilly ants evading the foot about to crush their hill. I, however, am stillness personified as I stand outside the precinct's tall glass window. Sam is inside, talking to Detective Hernandez, hopefully telling her the same things I did. And although I appear content to remain motionless, all I really want to do is run. Not toward home, but away from it. I long to run until I reach the George Washington Bridge, where I'll keep running. Through New Jersey, through Pennsylvania and Ohio, vanishing into the heartland. Only then will I be away from the reality of what I'd done in the park. Away from the brief, confounding flashes of Pine Cottage that still cling to me like a sweat-soaked shirt. Most of all, I'd be away from Sam. I don't want to be here when she emerges from the police station. I'm afraid of what I'll see, as if one look will reveal the guilt on her face as bright and glaring as her red lipstick. But I stay, even though my legs tremble with pent-up energy. I want a Xanax so badly I can already taste the grape soda on my tongue. I stay because I could be wrong about Sam. I want to be wrong. So she was in Indiana while Lisa was still alive. In all likelihood, their paths never came close to crossing. Indiana is a big state, after all, with more to it than just Muncie. Sam's presence there certainly doesn't mean she went to see Lisa. And it's definitely no reason to suggest Sam killed her. That I immediately jumped to that conclusion says more about me than it does her. At least, that's what I try to tell myself as I huddle against the chill, my legs twitching, wondering what exactly Sam is saying deep inside the building behind me. She's been in there 20 minutes now, far longer than I. Worry nudges my sides, riling me up, making me want to run even more. I yank my phone from my pocket and run the pad of my thumb across its screen. I think about calling Coop and confessing all my sins, even if it means he'll hate me. Short of running, it's the only logical course of action. Face my misdeeds. Let the chips fall. But then Sam emerges through the precinct's glass doors, smiling like a kid who's just gotten away with something. The grin sets off a lightning bolt of fear in my heart. I'm afraid that Sam has told the truth about last night. Worse, I'm afraid she's now on to my suspicions, that she instinctively knows what's going through my mind. Already, she sees something off about my expression. Her grin flattens. She tilts her head, assessing me.
"Relax, babe," she says. "I stuck to the script."
She has the purse with her. It dangles from her forearm, giving her a disconcertingly dainty appearance. She tries to pass it to me, but I take a step back.
I want nothing to do with it. Nor do I want anything to do with Sam. I keep an arm's length between us as we walk away from the police station. Even walking is a chore.